Welcome to the Connected Insurance Podcast, presented by Agency Revolution. Listen to interviews with the most influential people in the insurance industry. Learn the most important strategies, tactics, trends, and challenges facing today's independent insurance agents and brokers. New episodes every Wednesday. Visit agencyrevolution.com and click media to explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers. Subscribe today and get updates delivered right to your inbox. And now, without further delay, the Connected Insurance Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Michael Janz, co-founder of Agency Revolution. And I want to welcome you to this episode of the Connected Insurance Podcast presented by Agency Revolution. Creators of Fuse, the insurance marketing software that skyrockets retention, boosts policy per customer, and makes your clients love your agency. Without you having to hire more staff, programmers, or technologists, visit agencyrevolution.com and request a demo of the award-winning software that agents and brokers are raving about today. One of the intriguing and challenging questions that has perplexed me for 25 years is why the life insurance sale is so often a challenge and a difficulty in so many P&C agencies. I dive into that very question with Chris Jarvis, our guest today. He's been an actuary on the P&C side, but also a million-dollar producer and an author of 15 books, most recently, Six Secrets to Leveraging Success, as well as the 12-day turnaround course for agents and agencies. And we dive into these questions like, why do so many agencies struggle with it? What are the common mistakes that they're making? How can we overcome those mistakes when the life sale is in some ways transformative in the relationship between the agency and the client? Why don't we take it more seriously? So I really want to invite you to listen deeply to this conversation and then ultimately make your own decision about what's right for your agency. So now, without further ado, it is my privilege to introduce you to this conversation with Chris Jarvis. Chris Jarvis, thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. How about yourself?
I am good. Thank you. Let's start with a thumbnail sketch of a little bit about your background and then the kind of unique contributions you're making in the industry right now.
Sure. So I have the very common background of being a property casualty actuary by training and someone who has spent a lot of time in marketing and sales. So
okay.
You can laugh at the combination. So I've seen the dark side twice. I guess I went for the... as a mathematician, I went for the two negatives makes a positive. I jumped from the P&C side to the life side,
yeah.
And I jumped from the back office, make the rates, and do all the, you know, the heady, bean counting, to the sales and marketing. So I have had the pleasure of creating insurance companies and doing filings for insurance companies and product creation. I've also sold millions of dollars of life insurance to corporations and wealthy people.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, you were a million-dollar producer once upon a time, right?
Yeah, as recently as last year.
Not that long ago, okay.
Not that long ago. It happens when it happens, and we'll probably get into some of the reasons how or ways that it happens, I'm sure, on this podcast, but yes.
All right. So a little background. I had a conversation with Matt Messiello, the CEO of SIAA, yesterday. And one of the things that he talked about was, I think it was a fairly strong advocacy for P&C agencies to start selling life, right? Life insurance. And I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting because I know I'm going to be talking to you today. So I really want to circle back to that. That's a critical element. And I think... it's just important that we face it honestly. P&C agencies have the opportunity to sell life insurance. Typically, they don't. I haven't seen the number lately, but I remember that at least at one point in time, life and benefits combined to, you know, for a whopping total of 7% of the average agency income. Now, maybe it's higher now, but not much. So, and setting benefits aside, the relationship that the PNC agency typically has with life insurance is just often difficult and strained and awkward. So I want to dive into that and get your perspective on, what are the best of the best doing in that world. But first, I know that you had a best-selling book that came out even less than a year ago. And I wanted to get a few of your most interesting insights about it. Six Secrets to Leveraging Success, name of the book.
It is.
Right. And it's available where?
It's available on Amazon.
There we go.
And, closing retail bookstores everywhere.
Yeah, closing bookstores everywhere. Okay.
On my website, it's a bunch of different places. But Amazon's the easiest. That's the one that people know how to spell and know how to find. And
all right.
So
before we dive into some of that juicy life insurance stuff, what inspired you to write this book?
That's a good question. What inspired me? What was a little different was I've written more than a dozen books, and I've had a couple big successes. I spent the majority of my time with the first 80-90% of those books, I was spending my time trying to generate leads and trying to create clients. And I did that to the tune of more than 10, 15,000 doctors and business owners called me over the years as a result of books. So that was very successful. The last two books, I spent time trying to teach people. So I was challenged by my mentors, Jack Canfield and Jay Abraham, to say, why don't you put together what made you successful and see if you can put it in words in a way that not only explains your story, but also gives some valuable tips to other people as part of your legacy.
Uh-huh.
Think about how you can help others. And I said, okay, I'll take that challenge.
And
what I started researching was the difference between successful people and super successful people. That was really the idea of leveraging success. There's a lot of people who are successful, but there are many fewer people, obviously, who are at that higher level. And how did I define that?
I thought,
when I started writing this, it was the election, all the campaigning was going on, and there was a lot of talk about the 1%, magical, if not nefarious, 1% of Americans who make more than $300,000. And I started thinking about the 1%, but because I spent a lot of time doing tax planning as part of my financial planning practice, I was talking to hundreds, if not thousands, of really successful people who wanted to save taxes. And oddly enough, if you want to save taxes, it's probably because you're making a lot of money.
Right.
And if you're making a lot of money, you're usually doing something really odd. There's something about your business that makes you super successful. It's not because you're a little faster. It's not because you're a little more ethical. It's not because you're a little cheaper. There's not a little of something. There's a lot of something that gets you to that level. And the difference between the 1% or the 0.1% or the 0.01% was pretty amazing. What I found was that the biggest indicator of success to get into the top 1% was education. If you had if you went to law school or business school, or you had a degree or a couple degrees, or maybe you had a degree and then you had some professional designations, you took your time to get your CPCU or your CFP, or there was some other training, those things helped you get to the next level and get into the 1%. But what was really interesting was that inside of the 1%, if you got rid of everybody who makes less than $300,000 a year and looked at the remaining group, the ones who make the most money actually have the least amount of education. So education gets you there, and then education holds you back.
Is that education holding the other, the rest of the 1% back, or is it
I think it is, because what I found was that you can get to the 1% by working hard, but you can't get to the 0.01% by working hard. You have to get to a point where you stop working hard, and those lessons that your parents or your grandparents or whoever it was that told you to work hard and really put the time in, and whoever your mentors were when you were in your 20s who just said hard work is going to get you there and make the cold calls and set the appointments, all that will get you there. But if you keep trying to do the work, you do run out of time, right? You can only see so many people. You can only service so many clients. You can only do so much until you start deciding to leverage. And the problem is, once you get successful from hard work, the idea of doing something else is a risk that most people won't take. They won't take the risk of saying, well, I used to do all this work, now I'm going to build a business, and now I'm going to do something very different to get to the next level. The risk is I might lose this business that's throwing off $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year, I don't want to take the chance. I have something to lose. So the people who work hard often won't make the risk of giving that up to try something else. And the people who get to the 1% and make a lot of money, many of them didn't have that work hard mentality. They just found a hack, if you will, which seems to be the popular language for these days. They found a hack to the system, which was, I'm going to build an app, or I'm going to do something that's going to allow me to make a lot of money and do something different. So I just find that once you make money from working hard, whether you're a doctor or you're a lawyer, an accountant, an agent, broker, once you have a book, the idea of going from working hard and servicing your clients to I'm going to run a really big company that I can sell, that's it's a heavy-duty shift that most people just won't make. Because it requires them to put something on the line that, is a lot to give up.
So do you think there are ways... So let me first clarify, or at least see whether or not I'm clear. A lot of people get to the... Well, 1 out of 100 get to the 1%, yeah?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's and typically, right. That's I did the math right on that. And that's so presumably across industry, PNC, life, financial planning, whatever, right? Okay.
Legal, any of it, sure.
And your observation is that it was education and hard work that gets a lot of people up to the 1%. But the right. But the 0.01, let's say, the 10% of the 1% or the 1% of the 1%, whichever one you're measuring, they take a different route, right?
Correct.
And I think you're saying that risk is a more predominant factor to make that jump?
I'm saying the hard part, the really hard part is very few people make it. I think the challenge of folks getting to this crystal ceiling, and that's one of the chapters in the book, is cracking the crystal ceiling, which is, it's a self-imposed ceiling. The glass ceiling is you can't get to the next level because of the color of your skin or your gender or your race or your religion or something else.
Yeah.
The crystal ceiling is put in there is something that you can't even see what's on the other side because you're just so busy doing what you're doing that you can't, there is no path to making, there's paths to becoming a partner at a law firm. You put the hours in, you bill, you do a little rainmaking, and then mm-hmm. you get to move up. But the crystal ceiling is, I don't even know how to make $1.9 million a year. There is no... or to make 4.6, or there is no path to getting or clear stairwell or ladder or whatever.
Right. Well, so typically, let's say if it's in personal production, that kind of tops out.
It does, right.
There's only so much time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so what do you think the super successful people do that breaks the bonds of time or mm-hmm. other limitations?
Well, they realize that to get further, they have to do something else. And that is the reason why some doctors can have a successful dermatology practice and make $600,000, $700,000 a year. But I have a client who sold his practice for $40 million.
Uh-huh.
So how do you do that? It was because he took Fridays off and didn't see patients and found a way to work on the business and make sure he understood how does the billing and coding work and how do we build ancillary services. I have to invest in building a business that could make money without me, as opposed to I'm going to see 12 more, 60 more patients, and bill again. I had to take a step back to move forward, or I had to actually spend money, whether it's direct or indirect, in paying people or just having somebody else see those patients and say I can't be building and working at the same time.
Got it. Okay, so I've interviewed a number of my own clients on this show, and of course have plenty that I haven't interviewed. And one of the observations, so tell me if this is in alignment with what you're talking about. So let's take, for example, a guest that I had on the show, Ellie Kaplansky. I'm pretty sure he's got the largest single privately owned agency in his state. Hasn't sold an insurance policy for goodness, 25, 35 years, right? So his focus very early on became building the business, not making sales personally. Is that the kind of distinction that you see between the 1% and the 0.01%?
Yes, I think that's part of it for sure. And if he started that way early, he was already realizing that if I might make 10% off the top by or 20%, whatever his number is, and I only have one employee, one agent broker working for me, I'm going to make 80% less than if I did the work myself. But he was smart enough to say, I'm playing the long game. When you think about insurance, a lot of people are thinking, how much of the case can I capture? How much of the revenue is mine? And that's all numerator. When, if you think about a fraction, it's how much you make divided by the time you spend. If you can minimize the amount of time you spend on each case, then as the denominator gets smaller, the value of the fraction goes up. So the less time you spend working, the more things you can actually get paid on. So he saw that early. Think about lawyers in a law firm. If you get origination credit versus hours you bill credit, you can only bill so many hours.
Right.
And you can insert attorney joke here about people, you know, billing more hours than exist. But if you get origination credit of 10% of the revenue for bringing in a Coca-Cola or a Gatorade or Under Armour or Nike or somebody with a big account, bringing it in, you get paid on all the work everybody else does. That's pretty good because it's a lot more hours than you could ever work. So I find that origination, how much business can you generate and get paid on, is a chance for you to have leverage. Again, that was by the title of the book.
Okay, so
how do you get paid on more hours than you have? And that's Richard Branson's comment was I read recently was all entrepreneurs I know that their time is worth more than their money. So I can't buy more time.
Yeah. Okay. So your book title is Six Secrets. I don't want you to go through all six of them, but is there anything else that's like a sort of a juicy and, maybe it was a surprising or really poignant finding for you when you did your research for the book?
Yeah, I have a chapter in there that you have to be psychotic to be successful. And what I mean by that is when I talk to my most successful clients, and these are people with 9 and 10-figure net worths, it was every one of them to a person. If you asked, what was your best idea? What was your biggest home run?
Uh-huh.
And they went through and told the story of their biggest home run. And you went back and said, when you first came up with it, can you remember doing that? And they say, of course I can remember where it was. And some have interesting stories about backs of napkins, and some have whiteboards, and some have legal pads, and some were drinking somewhere. I mean, they have these interesting stories. And then the next question is, do you remember what people said when you shared your idea? And the response is universal. It's everyone told them that they were crazy.
Uh-huh.
That that's a terrible idea. It will never work. Nobody will buy it. It's not going to fit. It's not good. I use the example of Gordon Logan with Sport Clips. He had gone to MIT and gone to Wharton and was a Big 8 accountant. And he said, I'm going to leave the accounting firm to go start a haircutting business for men and boys. And people said, Gordon, that's ridiculous. They're called barbershops, and there's tens of thousands of them. Why would you go compete with that? Fast forward, 10 years, 15 years, and he has 2,000 sport clip shops. He sponsors a Joe Gibbs NASCAR team. He sponsors a NASCAR race. He has a spectacular classic car collection, and he has a great life. And he's just one example of so many people that the great ideas are crazy. And in the chapter, there's a fair amount of psychology, not to bring everybody back to college and bore the hell out of them, but Maslow's hierarchy is you need to have food and water, to live. And then you need to have safety, not walk outside your cave and get eaten by a bear. And then the third thing is love and belonging, and you need to fit in. And I find that the most successful entrepreneurs don't need to fit in. And if you want to be in the 1 in 10,000, you can imagine it's a relatively rare group. So the more you want to be like your neighbors and be like the Joneses, if that's important to you, you won't get to that level if you want to be like everybody else.
Yeah.
If you want to go to the meetings and everybody go, oh, yeah, I'm doing the same thing you're doing, and I'm just like Steve, and I'm just like Mary, and I'm just like Mike.
Right.
Then if you want to be just like them, you can't be like them and make 10 times as much as they make.
And probably not going to transform the industry.
Correct.
All right. So let's talk about transforming the industry. So what first brought you to my attention was your perspective on life insurance in P&C. So tell me, let's start with kind of the state of the industry right now, and then let's kind of move it along to where you think it needs to go. So currently, when you look at the PNC industry and life insurance, how we doing, what's working, what's not?
Obviously, very mature industries, right? They've been around a long time. And decreasing margin, I think, is a safe assumption. I mean, some companies are making more money, but generally you're in any mature industry is usually in a decreasing margin industry. You've got challenges with compliance and regulations. You have a lot of threats from technology coming in. If you read the McKinsey or the Ernst & Young or the PricewaterhouseCoopers reports mm-hmm. on the insurance industry, they tell you it's a decreasing margin industry. You have to find alternative distribution channels. You have to find ways to shorten the sales cycle. You have to, Amazon does everything overnight. You know, sometimes even in my city in Dallas, I can get same day delivery if I order something before noon. And, you know, the insurance analysis part can take a long time, right? Life underwriting takes a long time.
Yeah.
Even, you know, doing the risk management assessment of a company to figure out what the right portfolio is can take some time. So there's a lot of pressure. So I would say there's a lot of change coming, or at least a lot of threats to change.
Now, the change or the threat, are you referring to the life insurance industry or to the PNC agency itself?
I think both.
Uh-huh.
I think both will be subject to technology changes for sure. I think the life side, which is just so archaic in so many ways, is destined to be changed dramatically. I think the only thing that has kept it from changing sooner is the fact that the regulators have these crazy capitalization requirements, so most of the private equity and investors aren't that interested in parking that much capital, you know, for a chance to make money. So you can't get those really big hits when you have to park $1 billion in the, you know, in reserves or something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's that has probably, the high regulation is usually not something that attracts technology investors. So that's probably, you know, kept it there. But that doesn't mean, I think there was an article, I can't remember which business magazine published it recently, but it said something like 20% of consumers would buy insurance from Amazon or Google. And these were people who had policies with really big name companies.
Yeah.
And so that should scare some folks, that people think that Amazon or Google is a better way to buy life insurance than through an agent or broker. And, you know, Amazon and Google, last I checked, have no history of paying claims and being there, you know, and they've actually sold some data. So what an interesting, you know, just so interesting that they think that that's a safe and easy place to do something, you know, versus a 170-year-old insurance company that's been paying claims for, you know.
So is this a good time for PNC agencies to be more aggressive or assertive with their life sales?
I think it's imperative that the PNC folks consider the life sales. For the same reason 10, 20 years ago when I was meeting with investment folks, I was telling them that they should be getting into the life insurance business, not because they wanted to, but because the life people were going to start selling their products. So some of this is your clients need a whole wide range of services, right, to be, you know, if there's a whole insurance portfolio that they need, and if you only serve policies from, you know, column A, and the person who serves policies from column B stays in column B, there's no threat. But as soon as the column B agent starts selling products in column A, now you've got a problem because they're talking to your customers
mm-hmm.
because you don't provide what they need. So you start running into that challenge, and there's been so much consolidation with private equity firms jumping into the insurance world. There are heavy-duty acquisitions going on right now, and you and I talked about this in the pre-call. Gallagher just bought Partners Advantage, which has thousands of agents licensed around the country. And so Gallagher's obviously a big player.
Yeah.
They, if they're buying and spending nine figures on a life insurance distribution company
mm-hmm.
with thousands and thousands of agents, I mean, why do you think that is? They've got to have a plan, and you know, these big company acquisitions haven't been integrated particularly well in my experience, watching the Hubs and the Gallagher and the BB&T and everybody else do all these acquisitions. I haven't seen one that's been spectacular yet, but it's not stopping them from throwing money at it. So I think you have to be mindful of what are your competitors doing, and you know what's your plan to make sure that your best customers aren't getting their life and employee benefits and executive benefits from one of your competitors. That's a dangerous place.
Okay. So what do you think distinguishes the PNC agency that does this right and the PNC agency that doesn't? So and my observation working with thousands of agencies over the past 25 years is that I can try to inspire, cajole, persuade, push, nudge. Unless somehow there's some element of passion or at least understanding and the business systems put in place, it doesn't work.
Right.
So what do you think distinguishes the ones that work from the ones that don't?
The ones that, let me share what I've seen, and you can tell me because you have more experience than I do. But what I've seen in a lot of these cases is really a half-assed approach at it. You know, I can't find a better word for that. And that they say, okay, we want to do life insurance. And they find one life guy who's the friend of, you know, some cronyism or some friend of one of the guys who works there. And they just bring him in and say, he's going to sell life insurance to all of our clients.
Work our book. Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to work our book. Now, let's think about it. If I'm the life guy who comes in and your boss tells you to introduce your clients to me so I can go sell some life insurance to them, you've done... What's the average client take to acquire? I mean, how much time does it take and how much effort for you to get one of those clients? And it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do is hand over your client, one of your best clients or any of your clients, to someone you don't know who's a transactional salesperson. And that if that situation doesn't go well, that one little bit of disruption to your client relationship could be the reason why that client you spent years developing decides to go shop your business somewhere else.
So let's say I'm the agency principal. I've got 7,500 clients, and I've worked really hard to get them, to keep them, to create some level of loyalty. And now you're gonna call them as a life guy, and I just don't want you to destabilize what I've got. Do you think is that the resistance?
I think it is, and for good reason, because a lot of life guys are transactional guys.
Talk about that. Yeah, the transactional versus relational kind of selling here that happens, like that seems split between the two industries. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, think of how people are paid.
Right.
If you spend years, securing a corporate account to come in and bring their entire PNC portfolio over to you, and let's say, what's a good account? $100,000 in revenue, $50,000 in revenue, whatever it is. It's a decent size revenue. You've got overhead and expenses, and most people probably say that the book becomes profitable after, 3 years, 2 years, 4 years. There's some period of time that you say, okay, this client's becoming really valuable. We can't afford to get people for 1 year and then have them leave. That's not a good model for
us.
So we want to keep the clients for a couple of years, and that usually works for us, and that justifies the long cycle of trying to build relationships and rapport and trust with these clients we want to bring over. So you get paid over time, and you get the renewal. You know, some lines the renewal is the same as the initial commission. Sometimes it's less, but you do get paid for the life of the client. Where on the life side, many of the commissions, the way that they're structured, is the payouts are huge up front, and you might get 90 to 95% of the compensation in year one. So I don't care what the agent says about the transaction or how important the relationship is. If you pay somebody the bulk of the money in year one, you would assume you're going to get the bulk of the service in year one.
Right.
Because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
So if you pay me $100 to show up for the first 10 minutes of work and you pay me a minute for every hour after, I mean, how much time do you think I'm going to stay? So I think it's natural that because the traditional compensation in life is to be way up front and it moves on, that you've created this weird diversion or divergence of kind of attitudes or relationships where the life guy is making all the money up front, the PNC guy doesn't make money until you've had the client for a few years, then I don't I don't care what industry I'm in. If I've got two different people with very different attitudes, and I'm a relationship guy, I don't want somebody who's all about the quick hit.
All right. So, well, what do we do about it? Okay, because you've kind of described life as it is, right? Because for the most part, those are the commission schedules and the two industries. So, what do we do?
Well, some of it's already been done for you. So, life insurance has been purchased in very large numbers in the last 10 years by banks and other corporations. And so the companies had to come up with institutional products, some of the BOLI and COLI, and that stands for bank-owned life insurance or corporate-owned life insurance. Banks started creating products that, insurance companies started creating products that had high cash, meaning the policies had, that the surrender values were nearly 100% of the premium paid. And the way they did that was by spreading the commissions out over 5, 7, 8, 10 years, depending on the product and the company.
Okay.
So there are products that once upon a time didn't exist, then they were only available to institutional purchasers or owners of policies, and now they're available to everybody. So you've got a lot of policies now that are available that look more like PNC policies. They pay over a long period of time, and if you stop servicing it and the client moves the policy, you won't get paid. So some of this the industry has already done for you, and when I share this with folks, whether they're PNC folks or they're accountants or they're attorneys who are all thinking about life insurance, it's amazing how few people know that these policies exist. And partly because the agents, a lot of them don't want people to know that they exist because they like the upfront. Right?
Yeah,
if you're getting paid, if you wake up every January 1 and only 10% of your income comes from renewals, it's a big change for you to go to, I'm going to get paid over 10 years on all my products because I've been living on those new policy commissions, pay my bills every year. So it's hard to make that transition. It's easy if you start that way, like your friend you mentioned earlier who started early on with, I'm going to build an agency. But it's very hard to go from a producer to owning an agency if you have to hand over your book to somebody else to service and take an 80% cut in your revenue. That's a hard thing for somebody to swallow. So I think the fact that the products exist for you to basically incent somebody to work the way you work, you now have a chance at least to work with those products. And most clients would be pretty happy with those products that say, hey, if you don't like us, move it somewhere else. You don't suffer. Yeah. We suffer if we don't do a good job. It aligns everybody's goals a little more. A little better than they were in the past.
Got it. All right. What else do you think PNC agents? So I think you're saying that this should become a kind of a critical department. Yeah. Life sales.
Yes, I do.
Or at least that agencies should make look at it with open eyes and make a conscious strategic decision about their relationship with life insurance.
They have to make a commitment to it and realize, and just bringing somebody in who's the old guard, oh, this guy sold a lot of insurance, he'll be great, he'll sell a lot of insurance. Well, if it pisses off all your brokers and agents to the point where they don't want to work with the person and they're not going to make the introduction, then it doesn't, 20% of zero is zero. So that doesn't help anybody. So I think making a commitment to doing it and finding someone who is willing to work in that, work in that capacity, which, once upon a time, it was great to hire people for commission only because you said there was no risk. But the risk here is actually that they upset your clients and you lose them. So there isn't any no-risk situation with a traditional model. I believe you make a commitment and hire some folks who want to work, for a little different structure.
Yeah.
A little more like the PNC agent, and you give them a draw and say, hey, we're happy to give you, take some of the risk out. But this is how we want to do it. These are the kinds of policies we want to use, and let's try and structure something a little differently so we can give our clients what they want and without disrupting our existing model or, the culture we have in our company.
Got it. All right. So let me ask you another question about sort of how to make this work in the operations of in a PNC agency. So to some extent, I think we've been talking about some of the bigger cases, right? Big corporate client or something. But let's say... let's say we've got a listener on the line right now with 5,000 customers, and they're a mix of personal lines, small commercial lines, and maybe a few middle market accounts. Boom, that's kind of a really good Main Street agency, right? In that case, you know, so typically, like a lot of cross sales are made a couple of ways. One, somebody makes an inbound call, customer makes an inbound call, and the CSR, you know, pops their records up on the agency management systems and says, you know, Chris, I'm concerned about something. I know that we protect your automobile, but you and I, we've never talked about homeowners insurance, and I'm just nervous that you're not properly protected, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And next thing you know, they get permission to quote and they make a sale. Or the agency is proactive enough to, let's perhaps reach out to all of the customers for whom they have home, no auto, right? And so they do a, you know, maybe it's a some kind of a marketing campaign, can be an email marketing campaign, boom. And so, yeah, those people, you know, it stimulates some of them to call and says, okay, it makes sense what you said. Yeah, tell me what you can do for me. Or they email and they say, all right, yeah, tell me what you can do. So whether it's passive or proactive, a lot of those cross sales are simply made by whoever the closer is, whether CSR or an inside producer or something like that. How do you see that happening with life insurance?
Well, teaching the old dog new tricks is nothing that I came up with. It's difficult, right? To take somebody who's been doing something a long time. So I teach sales training and client development and all that good stuff routinely to insurance folks. And one of the most important takeaways from any of the programs that I do, and I even built an online curriculum called the 12-Day Turnaround, which we may or may not talk about, but one of the really important lessons of things to do, the 10 or 12 things to do to change your practice, is to survey your clients. Every year, survey them, and you want to survey them about your service, and all that's pretty important. But serving the clients on what their biggest events are going to be for the next year, asking that question, whether it's something you do on the phone or it's something you send them, we survey clients, and the results are pretty amazing when you ask them, what is your biggest goal for this year, or do you plan to take on a new partner? If they plan to take on a new partner or sell off part of their practice, they probably need to change their buy-sell agreement. They probably need some buy-sell insurance. They probably need something. So surveying them tells you what they have coming up, what they have coming up for a big event. Uh-huh. Let's say if you ask them, do you plan to try and sell your company or to acquire another company this year? Then as soon as that happens, you can start bringing in the business valuation people. You can get involved earlier before you find out from your client they merged and the other person already brought their agent in, and you lost a really big case when you could have acquired a really big new client. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Asking those questions and surveying, those are things that aren't difficult to send when you send them either with a bill or with a statement. Or, one way to get people to fill them out is offer them a gift or, some kind of a thing to do that. I've seen some clients send out to their large base, we want to have, they basically said, we're going to do some education. Because you've asked us, or many of our customers have asked us to give them some educational, some training or seminars or webinars or materials, and these are some of the things that came up. Which ones are you most interested in? And we'll let you know when we have some materials for you. And it could be how to sell a business, how to leave a business to a future generation or whatever it might be. And people start checking boxes and sending back. And so the survey should happen before anything else, because you don't want to build a giant business valuation, buy-sell, consulting, and insurance shop until you hear from 50 of those 5,000 clients you have that, we all plan to sell our businesses or transfer them to our kids. Well, then you know who those 50 people are.
Yeah.
So I think the survey is the most valuable thing that you can put out to find out what's coming up, what's coming up before it comes up and surprises the hell out of you, because you don't want to meet your client for the annual review and say, hey, how was your year? Oh, I sold my company.
Lost opportunity.
Lost opportunity, right.
Yeah. Okay, got it. All right, so there is one last thing that I want to say about life insurance at a PNC agency, and I'm calling on some research that was done in the mid-90s. So goes back a ways, but I'm sure the principle is as solid as it's ever been. This is research that was done for State Farm. You know, and again, my audience are going to be largely independent insurance agencies, but the principle is solid. And here's what they discovered. Is that they knew exactly what their 10-year retention was for all of their customers that had one policy, all of their customers that had two policies, and all of their customers that had three policies. And the difference between one and two was spectacular, and the difference between two and three was mind-boggling, okay? So the 10-year retention, not 1 year, 10-year on one policy was 10%. Not bad, okay? State Farm's got a lot going for it in terms of promotion and customer nurturing. So, you know, not bad that they could keep 10 out of 100 customers for 10 years on one policy. At two policies, it was 38%. So, boom, we go from 10 to 38. That's like a, I mean, that's a fourfold jump. How did we do that? We got two policies. When they went from two to three, and that was home and auto. So they, typically they went from auto, home and auto, and then boom, add that third policy, a life policy. The 10-year retention was 90%, which is to me absolutely mind-boggling. That's not a one-year retention. That's they're 10 years later. They'd have nine out of 10 customers if they had those three policies. So the introduction, the successful introduction of that third policy is it's a game changer in regards to relationship. And I think we all intuitively know the more policies our customers have, the higher the retention is. Statistically, absolutely true. I did have somebody share, it was a life agent share a perspective on why he thought that life policy had so much impact. It's because the nature of the conversation is so intimate, because we need to talk about things like your death, your health, your family, your income. So the conversation, hard to get much more intimate with that. And so people go through that conversation. One, they probably don't want to have it, you know, with more strangers in the future than they absolutely have to. But two, you know, successfully and safely pursuing and negotiating that conversation creates a very deep psychological bond. So for what that's worth, I think this,
I agree with you. I think it's an emotional conversation.
Yeah, people think it's not. But insurance is emotional. Life insurance is really emotional.
Well, think about this. Think about the P&C. If you're doing commercial lines, P&C, which are the bigger accounts, so let's assume that that's the big, that's the bigger sale that people are trying to do. That conversation can be pushed down from the CEO or the founder down to the controller or the CFO or
somebody in business.
Because that's cost, right? This is a risk management decision. What's it going to cost, and how am I going to do this? And that's not a particularly exciting conversation. And I'm not trying to say that there's nothing interesting going on in P&C, but it's a risk management discussion that isn't personal. It's all about money. I'm going to pay you some money, and if something happens, you're going to pay me some money back. But the life insurance conversation is a very different conversation. What do you want to do? Who's going to be involved in your business? Which kid? Are you going to leave the kid the business? This kid the business? And what are you going to leave the other kid as an alternative? What happens if you pass away? It is a more personal conversation that you can't delegate to somebody else. It's very difficult to do that. So I do believe that that's an emotional conversation.
Right.
It's not the only way to have an emotional conversation, but I think that's a big part of a lot of the training that I do too, which is you need to get to know the customer as well as you can. And once upon a time, they used to do the McKay 66, and there were questions you had to ask your clients, and you wanted to get to know them a little better every time. And the better you knew them, the more they felt you understood them, the more likely they were to trust you and want to work with you. And so a lot of that went away, and it's not as personal in general. I think insurance isn't as personal as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And so it's always good to have those questions and get to know the people. There's no downside to that. And so I think that's probably why State Farm had such fantastic response, because it was such a deviation from the normal conversations they had that it wasn't just about price. What's it going to cost for $5 million of liability on this particular policy? That's an RFP type situation versus, ooh, this person really knows me and I feel like they're helpful at planning my, you know, my comprehensive situation. They know everything. So probably the P&C stuck because the people felt, well, I don't want to have to disrupt the P&C and the life. It's just more complicated.
Got it. In a moment, Chris, I'm gonna ask you to share how people can reach out to you. But first, if you could issue a message to the principals of property and casualty agencies now about this topic, what would you say?
I would say you have to understand your clients, and to understand, I guess I would say, think about catching a train. To catch a train, you don't stand on the track, listen for the sound, and chase the train. You go to the train, to the station where you think the train's going to show up, and you go at about the right time, and you catch the train because you know it's going to be there. So to just do what you've always done is a little dangerous in an industry where there's bound to be some disruption. If you talk to your clients and ask them what they have going on and where they are, they'll tell you what they want and what they don't want. So number one, get to know the clients and what they need, and then be mindful of what other people are doing, and that there are folks from other industries, not just from the life side, but there are folks coming into insurance to offer insurance a little differently, whether it's Lemonade or mm-hmm. it becomes Google mm-hmm. or Facebook or somebody else. So you've got to be doing, if you just sit around and wait, that's not a good plan. I just watched that movie World War Z with Brad Pitt, and it was post-apocalyptic, kind of like Walking Dead-ish. And he made a sign that I've been in a lot of bad places, and I found that people who keep moving survive, and people who sit around don't.
Got it.
And so I think that talk to your clients and keep innovating even when it's not obvious that there's a need for it. I would say think about that, and adding life is one of those things they should at least consider. And the products will, at least make it a little easier now than, maybe it would have been 10 years ago.
If somebody did reach out to you about this, Chris, what could you do for them? What kind of help could you provide?
Sure. I've consulted with, I might have mentioned it earlier, it's probably over 1,000 business owners in the last 20, 25 years. And whether they're running an agency or they're agents or entrepreneurs of whatever size business, I do consults, I sit on people's boards, I do retreats, corporate mm-hmm. retreats for senior management to sit down for a day and walk them through it. I've built sales training programs for people in telecom, to folks in insurance on both sides, to investment management firms. So this is some of what I do, and I like to find unique paths to success that are based on the culture and the skills and the client base of the client, mm-hmm. The customer, and then what they want to accomplish. So, that's some of the stuff that I do.
Got it. All right. So your book is available on Amazon and other places, right?
Yes.
Six Secrets to Leveraging Success.
Yes.
And then
my website has a bunch of, a lot of resources.
Yeah, that's right. You have a lot of, free content that's available,
I do. Much to the demise of my, or to the dismay of my, marketing team, but yeah, there's a lot of free stuff up there. There's some stuff for sale, and there's a lot of free stuff too.
Yeah.
And it's thechrisjarvis.com. So THE, and then my first name is Chris, CHRIS,
got it.
And the last name is Jarvis, JARVIS.
Thechrisjarvis.com. And so people can visit your site. Is there any other way that you encourage people to find out more about you or reach out to you?
I'm on LinkedIn and all the other good social media stuff, but I think you can get to all that from the website or through LinkedIn, and I have some free chapters of books and a bunch of videos and things if they want to get some idea of mm-hmm. what the heck I'm like and read testimonials and all that stuff. If I can be of assistance, I just enjoy trying to help business owners who are struggling crack that crystal ceiling and get to another level.
Crack the crystal ceiling. Okay. Chris, this has been a delight and eye-opening. I really, really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Been my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Insurance Podcast. If you found this episode informative, please share it with your peers and colleagues. Explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers by visiting agencyrevolution.com and clicking media. Subscribe and get updates delivered right to your inbox. New episodes every Wednesday.